From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Dave Frischberg writes very witty songs about contemporary life, lovely sentimental ballads, and he's a terrific pianist. On this edition of Fresh Air, you'll hear that for yourself when Dave Frischberg joins us for a concert. Amy Tan didn't want her second novel to read like Son of Joy Luck Club. But like Joy Luck Club, her second novel turned into a big bestseller. Coming up, Tan reads from that novel, the current bestseller, The Kitchen God's Wife. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the American premiere of John Adams' latest opera, The Death of Klinghoffer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Launch managers at Cape Canaveral discovered a communications problem between ground controllers and the Space Shuttle Discovery just minutes before its scheduled liftoff. The problem has delayed the launch. Dave Pignanelli reports live from the Kennedy Space Center.
The problem is apparently a link between the Johnson Space Center, which has the launch controllers, and the Kennedy Space Center, which has the launch managers. And the two centers are apparently not being able to communicate with each other. The anomaly happened at T-minus 9 minutes. They counted down to T-minus 5 minutes, which is where the countdown stands at this moment. Launch managers are now studying the problem and are evaluating whether or not it should affect the liftoff. The liftoff was supposed to occur at 6:57 Eastern Time, and we are still awaiting that liftoff. Discovery is supposed to race skyward to begin a 5-day mission to study planet Earth and release the upper atmosphere research satellite, which is to study the ozone layer. We are awaiting word now on whether or not the shuttle will lift off in just a few moments. Reporting live from the Kennedy Space Center, I'm Dave Pignanelli in Florida.
Israeli authorities are waiting for the return of the remains of an Israeli army sergeant who was captured in Lebanon in 1983. The soldier's body was returned to Israeli negotiators in Vienna today and put on a flight to Jerusalem, where it's expected to arrive soon. A Palestinian official said that the return of the body was part of a negotiation that would allow a deported Palestinian activist to return to the occupied territories. President Bush said today that he'll veto any attempt by Congress to grant Israel $10 billion in loan guarantees to help resettle new Jewish emigres. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush raised the stakes in the controversy over whether the U.S. should grant the loan guarantees to Israel now or wait 120 days. Without specifying how a debate now on the loan guarantees would endanger the peace process, he said the controversy could force one or more parties from the peace table.
And if necessary, I will use my veto power to prevent that from happening. Peace is what these new immigrants to Israel and indeed all Israelis long for.
The veto threat came as hundreds of pro-Israel activists lobbied on Capitol Hill in favor of granting the loan guarantees to Israel immediately. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
There was new optimism today about a possible release of some Western hostages in Lebanon. The Islamic Jihad kidnappers released a photograph of American Terry Anderson, along with a statement saying that the group supports the efforts of UN Secretary General Javier Perez de Cuellar. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 21 points to close at 3,007.8. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR. The United Nations Security Council recommended today that the newly recognized Baltic nations of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia be admitted to UN membership. The General Assembly is expected to admit the three countries by acclamation when it convenes next week. If so, the Baltics will be admitted along with North Korea, South Korea, the Marshall Islands, and Micronesia. There are now 159 members in the Assembly. Soviet Foreign Minister Boris Pankin said today that his government made the decision to withdraw its troops from Cuba without consulting the U.S. or the Cuban government first. But he suggested that the United States should now take a reciprocal step and cut back on its own military presence in Cuba. NPR's Tom Jelton reports from Moscow.
Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev's unexpected announcement yesterday that several thousand Soviet troops in Cuba would be withdrawn angered the Cuban government, Within hours, the Cuban Foreign Ministry issued a stinging statement complaining that they had not been consulted, that Gorbachev had overstayed at the Soviet troop presence on the island, and that he had erred in not demanding a U.S. troop cutback in return. The statement today here by Foreign Minister Boris Pankin may have been meant to soothe Cuban feelings. Pankin said Soviet officials now expect to discuss reciprocal steps that could be taken at the U.S. Guantanamo naval base in Cuba. He said Soviet officials would like to have advance notice of military maneuvers around Cuba and suggested that the maneuvers could even be halted completely. I'm Tom Jelton in Moscow.
The leader of one of the two major black nationalist groups in South Africa was quoted today as saying he doesn't believe a new three-way peace agreement will work. Mangosuthu Buthelezi, the leader of the Inkatha Party, is due to sign the peace pact with the African National Congress and South Africa's government. He told a reporter that the ANC is guilty of hypocrisy for being willing to sign a public agreement when it allegedly hasn't been willing to talk with Inkatha in private. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The jazz critic Mike Joyce once wrote that Dave Frischberg writes the kind of songs that Johnny Mercer and Woody Allen might have come up with had they ever collaborated. My guest is the best interpreter of Dave Frischberg's songs, Dave Frischberg. And as you'll hear, Frischberg is also a first-rate pianist. By the way, his early songs have just been re-released on a new album called Classics on Concord Jazz. And he has a recent album on Concord called Let's Eat Home. Frischberg lives in Portland, but he's on the East Coast for performances at Scholars in Boston and the Ballroom in New York. So we invited him to make a stop at our Philadelphia studios for a concert. Dave Frischberg, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
You've brought a brand new song with you, and I'd love to hear it.
Okay, great. I'd like to do it for you. I'll be late getting home from the office, and so will you. 'Cause we both got a million calls to return and a million things to do. We're not seeing enough of each other, 'cause truth be told, we're up to our ears in our careers, and we're putting our hearts on hold. So darling, let me bring you up to speed. A little time together's what we need. Quality time. We both deserve a little quality time. We'll find a small hotel, remote and quiet. In case they want to sell, my firm could buy it. Then we develop it and gentrify it. We're talking quality time. Quality time. We owe ourselves a little quality time. In the Bahamas, we can let our stress go. We'll walk along the beach and dine al fresco. I'll take a power lunch with Robert Vesco. We're talking quality time. Come fly with me. Unwind, kick back, relax. I'll bring my laptop fax. You'll work on your new screenplay. I'll update my resume. Quality time. A little frolic and frivolity time. We'll take a seminar on self-hypnosis so we can learn to stop and smell the roses. We'll do a workshop on the grieving process. Learning to cry is no crime. We're talking quality time. The tennis courts in our Adidas. Some influential sorts are bound to meet us. We'll play it smart, of course, and let them beat us. We're talking quality time. We'll find some upscale friends to share some space with. A wealthy couple we can interface with. A smart attorney we could start a case with. We're talking quality time. Come dine with me. This time you choose the wine. Romance is the bottom line. And later, when we're alone, hang on, there's my other phone.
we'll have a ball. But now I got to deal with this other call. We both been chewing more than we can bite off. We got to take at least a day and night off. I'll speak to Sid, he'll make it all a write-off. This may not cost us a dime. I'll fax you back with a plan of attack to let the quality time begin. We'll lock in the time frame, and you can pencil me in. Better pencil me in.
I love it.
Oh, thank you.
That's a great new song. You know, you do something that Cole Porter used to do, which is like incorporate like proper nouns, you know, like names of people from the people writing the song.
Right. And,
oh, that's a really funny song. You've gotten in everything.
That's my job.
You got your start as a pianist as opposed to a songwriter, pianist, and singer.
As a pianist, yes.
You were a sideman with a lot of musicians. You were a house pianist at one of the New York clubs. What made you realize that like your ultimate calling was going to be writing songs as well as playing and singing those songs too?
Well, as far as writing is concerned, I began to write soon after I got to New York and while I was a sideman, as you say, and I used to try to write so that other singers would be interested, or that because I never dreamed of myself as being the singer, and I would write to make other recording artists, I don't even know who they were, but to get their interest, to see if maybe, you know, who could it be, Connie Francis or Paul Anka, or would sing such a thing, you know, and it turned out that I was writing, I wrote terrible stuff, it wasn't very good, because I didn't mean it. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
I was kind of writing down to my song, and that doesn't make it. It was obvious that I wasn't really that kind of a writer, and I was just trying to write amateurishly. And so I stopped, and I began to just write what came naturally to me, and ended up being probably the only one who sings it.
What I like about composers singing their songs, you know, is that if you aren't like relying on a lot of technique, then there's something else in your voice. It's, you know what I mean, in addition to...
Well, my main purpose is to make sure that the words are all understood.
Well, I think composers like you have a way of kind of putting across a song and of putting a certain kind of, the right emotion, whether it's wit or sentiment. Do you know what I mean? Just kind of striking the right emotion in the way you're performing it.
Well, that could be. And if there's any technique to what I do as far as accompanying myself, I think it might lie in the fact that a lot of times I sing to silence. I stop playing when I sing certain songs, especially up-tempo jazz things, and I leave open spaces for my voice to execute the music. And then I hear other singers trying to do some of my up-tempo songs, and I wonder why it sounds cluttered, and I wonder why they express difficulty. That's a hard song, you know, to get those things out. Well, then I see, well, the reason I'm getting it out is because instinctively I stop playing behind myself at that moment and allow the words to happen. And, of course, that doesn't occur to them because someone else is playing the piano, and it wouldn't occur to him either, you know.
What's an example of a song where you lay out like
Well, for
that?
Instance, a song that, like Zoot Walks In, which is full of jazz articulation, you know. Jazz is a saxophone sound. Not every player's got his own sound. Well, you see how much there was silence in back of me. So other singers try to sing this, and they got piano player playing, jazz is a saxophone, so, you know what I mean? And they got
exactly.
All this stuff going on in back of them. Naturally, it sounds a little cluttered. I've noticed that myself recently. I can get the words out because I'm accompanying myself, and I know enough to stop playing at those moments.
Have you ever sang with anybody else accompanying you?
Oh, only for brief hysterical moments. I sang with a full orchestra once. That was really terrifying. In California, Peter Matz was conducting, and it was a tribute to Johnny Mandel, and I was doing a Mandel song called El Cajon with a full orchestra behind me. What a panicky feeling. I sent Peter Matz the music, and he called me back on the phone. He said, don't you want to put this maybe a whole tone higher or maybe a minor third higher? I said, well, gee, I can't sing that high. He says, well, you got it in a very confidential key. And I realized that you know, I wrote most of my keys for myself in a range that I can handle, but it is a confidential one. And when you got an orchestra in back, if you can't sing like that, you can't sing. Jazz is a saxophone. You got to sing. Jazz is a saxophone. You got to do it because otherwise you're not going to be heard. See, so that's terrifying to sing with an orchestra, and it's also scary to sing with another piano player. I did that a couple of times. It's like jumping out of a plane without a chute. You know?
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll hear some music with our guest, Dave Frischberg. We'll be back in a couple of seconds. This is Fresh Air. My guest is singer, songwriter, lyricist, pianist, Dave Frischberg. And by the way, he has a couple of recent albums I want to tell you about. One's called Let's Eat Home, and that's his latest new recording. But there's an even newer recording that's actually a collection of his earlier songs. And these are songs collected from a couple of out-of-print albums. And it's called, appropriately, Classics. Both of these records are on Concord Jazz. And for our listeners in Boston, Dave Frischberg is headed your way to perform with Carol Sloan at Scholars on the 13th and 14th, and is headed for New York after that, 17th through the 22nd at the Ballroom. Dave, you got another song for us?
Sure. I thought maybe I'll play the piano a little bit, huh?
Sure. Oh, yeah.
I always end up playing Duke Ellington music. I don't know why. I just seem to gravitate toward it. He's one of my favorite people. This is The Mooch. Duke wrote this in the late 1920s. And in the middle of it, I've incorporated a more recent Ellington tune called Jones. I kind of slide into that in the middle. Thank you.
what you do with that. I really think of the Mooch. Maybe there's like an Ellington solo record, and I'll sound stupid because I don't know about it. But I think of the Mooch as being one of the Ellington compositions that really accentuates the reed section with you know, the reeds kind of sliding between notes and wailing.
Yeah, right, right.
Is it a hard one to do at the piano, to figure out what to do with it at the piano?
Not really. I mean, I do something different with it, I guess, every time. But I do kind of plan for it to peter out at the end. Got the right guy, right?
You said something once to Whitney Balliot of The New Yorker about lyrics that I quite like, that good lyrics come up to the edge of poetry and turn left.
Well, it's one of those things I wish I had never said. It's utter nonsense. I have no idea what that means.
Oh, I know what it means to me.
Well, I don't know. I guess I knew it at the time what it meant to me, too, but I was horrified to see that he wrote it down and used it.
Well, I'm just here to, I guess, embarrass you.
Well, no, I don't know what that means, but I do know that I think a better, more telling little aphorism was said by Frank Lesser, who said that lyric writing is not literature and it's not poetry, it's journalism. And I think that really says it.
Since we're talking about lyrics, let me ask you to do another of your own. And I think we've got a song coming up that's, I think it's really become one of your most popular
Sweet
songs.
Kentucky Ham.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's one of my most popular, but I was very flattered and pleased to receive a book in the mail the other day from a writer named Terry Teachout. He's written memoirs called City Limits about his life as a young boy and as a student in Sykeston, Missouri. And he quoted this song, Sweet Kentucky Ham, as part of a chapter on life on the road with a jazz band, Woody Herman. And I was very pleased. It's a terrific book, by the way. Would you like to hear this song?
No, I was just pretending.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here it is. It's 6 p.m. Supper time in South Bend, Indiana. And you figure what the hell you can eat in your hotel. So you order up room service on the phone. Watch the local news and dine alone. You got to take what little pleasures you can find when you've got sweet Kentucky ham on your mind, nothing but sweet Kentucky ham on your mind. It's 10 p.m. They're rolling up the sidewalks in Milwaukee. And the only place to eat is just across the street. So you sit there with a bowl of navy bean. And you turn the pages of your magazine. And you feel you want to quit while you're behind. 'Cause you've got sweet Kentucky ham on your mind, nothing but sweet Kentucky ham on your mind. And you feel like you're forever on the phone. 10:30, let it ring. Dial again, same damn thing. And you're really getting hungry for some talk. Grab a shower. Take a walk. It's 1 a.m. They're serving up Last Call in Cincinnati. It's still a nighttime town if you know your way around. And despite yourself, you find you're wide awake. And you're staring at your scrambled eggs and steak. And you must admit your heart's about to break when you think of what you left behind. And you got sweet Kentucky ham on your mind, nothing but sweet Kentucky ham on your mind?
Really nice.
Thank you.
Dave Frischberg. It has been a real treat to have you here. I really want to thank you for coming and playing for us. It's really been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Terry. And if it wouldn't embarrass you, I'll say that I listen to you nearly every day when I get a chance, and I think you're the best at what you do.
Thanks.
And I'm
thank you.
Pleased to be on your show.
Thanks. I've been wanting to do this for a long time, so I'm glad we were really able to work it out. My guest has been Dave Frischberg, songwriter, singer, pianist, and let me mention new records that are out and where he'll be playing. In the new records category, we have Classics, which is a collection of his earlier songs, back in print on the Concord Jazz record. Concord Jazz label. It's called Classics. And then his latest recording of new songs is called Let's Eat Home, also on Concord Jazz. For our listeners in Boston, Dave Frischberg is headed your way to play with Carol Sloan, to perform with Carol Sloan at Scholars on the 13th and 14th. Then on the 15th, he's in Woonsocket. And then at the 17th through 22nd in New York at the Ballroom. So let me say, I'm Terry Gross and this is Fresh Air. And Dave, would you play us out?
Certainly.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Amy Tan's first novel, The Joy Luck Club, was the story of Chinese emigre women and their Americanized daughters. Coming up, Amy Tan tells us why she decided to tell her own mother's story in her second novel, The Kitchen God's Wife. It's entering its 12th week on the bestseller list. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews The Death of Klinghoffer. It's the latest collaboration between composer John Adams and director Peter Sellers. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Israel has announced that the body of an Israeli soldier missing in Lebanon since 1983 is now on its way back to Israel. The announcement raised hopes for a breakthrough in the hostage crisis. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The body of Israeli Druze soldier Samir Assad was expected in Israel in the early morning hours. The body was flown from Vienna after the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine turned it over to the Red Cross. Israel thanked both the Red Cross and the Austrian government for their help. In return, Israel agreed to allow a deported Palestinian to return to the West Bank. Ali Abu Hilal, a union activist and active member of the Democratic Front, was deported to Jordan in 1986 after he was accused of organizing guerrilla activity. The army spokesman said Abu Hilal's return is conditioned upon his agreement not to break the law in the future. Abu Hilal is the first deportee allowed back since the beginning of the Palestinian uprising almost 4 years ago. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
President Bush says that he will use a veto if he has to delay action on Israeli loan guarantees of some $10 billion. In the face of rising opposition, Mr. Bush said that he is making this threat because there appears to be a near breakthrough in efforts for Middle Eastern peace talks. Arab countries are afraid the loans could be used to settle Soviet immigrants in disputed territory. Talks are expected to begin next month, but no time or place has been set. Mr. Bush said that he would not say which nation he thought might not attend a peace conference if Congress began a debate on loan guarantees. The Space Shuttle Discovery has finally made it into space. A communications problem delayed the launch slightly, but NASA says that everything is going well. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE has more on the story.
The Space Shuttle Discovery is now parked in orbit to begin its 5-day mission to study planet Earth, more specifically, Earth's upper atmosphere. Late Saturday night, Discovery's crew will deploy the Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite. The 7-ton UARs will circle the globe in a near-polar orbit, making a pass over Antarctica to study what scientists say is a giant hole in Earth's ozone layer. This is NASA's first major project in the Mission to Planet Earth program, a multi-year effort to study global warming, ozone depletion, and related environmental concerns. The mission will end with a night landing back at the Kennedy Space Center. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida.
The government says that new claims for unemployment benefits fell by 1,000 during the last week in August to a seasonally adjusted 420,000. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 21 points to close at 3,007.83. This is NPR News. During the third day of nomination hearings for Judge Clarence Thomas to the U.S. Supreme Court, questions veered from the abortion issue to issues of natural law and his tenure as head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. In the meantime, the Leadership Council of Aging Organization has announced its opposition to the Thomas nomination, charging that his record as EEOC head raises questions about the nominee's qualifications. The group says that it's the largest coalition concerned with policy issues for older people. In the Philippines, communist forces have declared a ceasefire in their 22-year-long rebellion. These forces are responding to strong signals that U.S. bases are about to be evicted from the country. Pat Ford reports from Manila.
The National Democratic Front, which includes the Communist New People's Army, announced the nationwide unilateral ceasefire. Eviction of the U.S. bases has long been a key NDF demand, and a statement said the Philippine Senate is showing a clear trend toward rejecting a new base treaty. Earlier this week, the Senate rejected the treaty in a preliminary vote, and it appears ready to defeat the treaty in the final vote Monday. Anti-treaty senators say even President Corazon Aquino is resigned to the treaty's defeat after meeting with senators today. The NDF statement said it hoped the ceasefire would lead to the immediate start of peace negotiations. It called on the Philippine military to reciprocate, but the Armed Forces Chief of Staff expressed doubt about the sincerity of the offer. For National Public Radio, this is Pat Ford in Manila.
The FAA has ordered modifications and inspections of planes with an engine braking system, like the one that may have failed on Alaska Airlines' Boeing 767 earlier this year. The plane crashed, killing all people on board. The FAA order directs operators of some 179 Boeing 757s with Pratt & Whitney 2000 engines to replace a valve. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. When I interviewed Amy Tan in June, her novel The Kitchen God's Wife had just come out. No one except book critics had read it yet. Now that her novel is entering its 12th week on the bestseller list, we thought we'd play that interview again. Amy Tan is that rare writer whose first novel was both a critical success and a bestseller. The Joy Luck Club juxtaposed the stories of four Chinese women who fled their country in the 40s with the stories of their Americanized daughters. Tan says she didn't want her second book to be Son of Joy Luck, and in a way, The Kitchen God's Wife is what she promised herself she wasn't going to write. It's about the relationship between a Chinese mother who fled her country in the 40s and her Americanized daughter. Both the mother and daughter are keeping secrets from each other, secrets each think the other would be totally unable to comprehend or accept. But a sick relative threatens to divulge the secrets unless the mother and daughter come clean. Most of the novel is given over to the mother story about life with her husband, a cruel man who raped her repeatedly. Tan told me there was a good reason she returned to the territory of telling a Chinese mother's story.
It was a request from my mother. She had spent so many times having to tell her friends and acquaintances that she was not the mothers in the Joy Luck Club. And she came up to me one day and she said, as I was struggling to write the second book, she said, "Next book, tell my true story." And with her request, you know, how could I refuse? Because she had been really so much a part of the first book. She wanted me to write more about what had actually happened to her in China. And for such a long time, I knew just the sketchiest of details. I had always felt that it would be too painful for her to talk about everything that had really gone on, all the worst things. And so I asked her more and more about the times that she had lost her children or about her marriage to a very terrible man, a man whose name she could not even tell me until that time when she finally said, "Please tell my story." And she told me the name of the man, and I changed it, of course, but that became really the reason why I wrote The Kitchen God's Wife.
I'm going to ask you to read a passage from The Kitchen God's Wife, and this is a passage in which the mother has a lot of difficulty.
Yes.
Talking to the daughter, because it's such a painful part and it's such a personal part. And it's a passage where the mother's telling the daughter about how the mother's first husband abused her sexually and physically.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything else you'd like to say in setting up this passage?
Well, this is a scene that happens when she has been married for only a few months. She is telling her daughter about the time that they lived in Hangzhou when her husband was training to become an Air Force pilot. And in this, she talks about the loss, the early loss, beginning loss of her innocence. "And now I have come to the part where I must be frank. I was thinking I should not talk about these things with you, sex things. But if I didn't tell you, then you would not understand why I changed, how he changed. So I will tell you what happened, although maybe not everything. Maybe I'll come to a part where I cannot say any more. And when that happens, you just have to imagine what happened. And then you should imagine it again and make it 10 times worse. Every night when Fu wanted me, and it was not the same way as when we were at his parents' house. I had been shy then, and he had been gentle, always coaxing me, soothing me, stopping when I became too afraid before I screamed too much. But in Hangzhou, he said it was time I learned how to be a proper wife. I thought I was going to learn something that would make me less afraid. I was still nervous, of course, but I was ready to learn. The first night in the little monastery room, we were lying in that narrow bed. I wore my nightgown when Fu had only his pants on. He was kissing my nose, my cheeks and shoulders, telling me how beautiful I was, how happy I made him. And then he whispered to me to say dirty words, words for a woman's body parts, not any woman's parts, a saltwater whore's, the kind who would give her body to foreign sailors. My ears hurt just to hear them. I pulled away. I cannot say those words, I finally told him. Why is this? He asked me. And he looked gentle, very concerned. A woman cannot say these things, I said, searching for a reason. And then I laughed, just a little, to show him I was embarrassed even thinking about it. Suddenly his smile went away, and he was a different person. He sat up quickly. His face was ugly, mad, and I became scared. I sat up too and stroked his shoulder, eager to win him back. Say them, he shouted suddenly. He repeated the words, 3 or 4 dirty words. Say them, he shouted again. I shook my head and began to cry, and then he became tender again, wiping my eyes and saying how much he cared for me, rubbing my back and my neck until I thought I would faint with relief and joy. He was only teasing, I thought happily. How stupid of me. And then he was helping me to stand up. He lifted my nightgown off, and when I was naked, he took my 2 hands and looked at me sincerely. Say them, he said in a quiet voice. And hearing this once again, I started to collapse to the floor. But before I could do so, he pulled me back up, dragged me toward the door like a bag of rice. He opened the door, then pushed me outside into the corridor of the monastery, where anyone passing by could have seen me naked like that. What could I do? I could not shout. Someone would awaken, look out, and see me. So I was whispering to him through the door, pleading, "Open the door, open." And he said nothing, did nothing, until several minutes had passed, and I finally said, "I will say them." After that, it was the same way every night. Here is where you should imagine more. Here is where you should make it worse.
I think that those last sentences are among my favorite in your novel, the idea of here's where you should imagine more, here's where you should make it worse. It communicates to me a couple of things, you know, both the shyness of the mother and, you know, her difficulty in talking about this, but also the inability of words to convey the proper degree of pain and horror. Did your mother say that to you when she was telling you the story?
She did in the same tone of feeling, where she almost could not explain in English to me how bad it really was. And she also felt that with the experiences I had lived through as an American, that I couldn't possibly understand what it was that was so much worse. And it was also very painful for her, because as my mother was telling me about her life, she would jump up or she would wave her arms, and I could see in her eyes as though she was reliving exactly what was happening at that time. And I was afraid to ask when she said, "Here's where you should imagine that it was worse." At that point, she could see in my eyes, I was afraid to ask, "What was it?"
Novelist Amy Tan is my guest, the author of the bestseller The Joy Luck Club and a new novel called The Kitchen God's Wife. We'll take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Amy Tan is my guest. It's really very difficult, I think, for most mothers and daughters to talk about anything sexual, let alone for a mother to tell the daughter about how she was sexually abused. Do you think if you hadn't been a novelist, if you hadn't started telling stories about your mother's generation, that she would never have told you this?
I think in a way she wouldn't have told me in such detail, because she had told me things about her marriage and about being tortured. The way she would tell me was, I was mentally tortured. You cannot imagine. It was like my skin would be crawling every single day, every minute, every moment, and I couldn't stand it and I couldn't get away. But it took a while before she could tell me where that feeling came from. And I think it was with the ears of both a novelist and a daughter that she was able to go into much more of where those feelings came from. And I think she knew that I was listening with my heart, because as she would tell things and she would be crying, I would be crying with her, but not holding back and not wanting to say too much, because I wanted it to be completely her story and not trying to shape questions to get something out that I wanted as a novelist.
Has it been difficult to get your mother's voice or the voice of her generation as a writer? I know it's a voice you've heard all of your life, but that doesn't mean it's easy to get it when you're writing.
It was a challenge, because I think when you write in a voice that's different, if it's an Asian American voice, that, you know, you can very quickly go to the point of parody and have a voice that just sounds very comical. I wanted to find a voice that was her voice, meaning conveyed her passions and her intent and the nature of her thoughts, and at the same time, her intelligence and her way of looking at the world. I had used started off with the Chinese thinking, which is how my mother talks. She translates directly from Chinese, and her language is full of images and expressions that you wouldn't find in English. And I would take that in, then I would change it to another kind of language, and so it's something in between. But I did have to work on that for quite a while, and now it becomes, it's not that it's easy, but it's something that has become much more natural. When I get into the rhythm of that, suddenly I began to think like this character.
One last thing. Have you been revealing a lot to your mother in the past few years, as she's been revealing a lot to you?
I do reveal thoughts that I have about, we talk a little bit about, you know, the success of this book and what it means, and about luck, and about my feelings about my father, which were very difficult for me to talk about. We talk about, compare our perspectives on what happened as I was growing up as a child and misunderstandings. And now we can give both sides and laugh about it and come up with a new version. That's been a wonderful, tremendous thing. I think that's also what happens in fiction. I mean, if there's anything that I've learned as a fiction writer, is that there is no absolute truth to anything. And it really takes, you know, sometimes several viewpoints or hundreds of viewpoints, or in the case of war, millions of viewpoints before you come to the truth of something.
Amy Tan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Amy Tan's latest novel is The Kitchen God's Wife. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, what do you have on the Clarence Thomas hearings?
Yet another day of testimony by the nominee. More questions about what his views on natural law actually are, how they apply to not only abortion but also anti-discrimination cases. We'll also have a report on a hearing on the House side of Capitol Hill today, a hearing examining the fire in Hamlet, North Carolina, at the chicken processing plant, a fire that claimed the lives of 25, in part because the doors to that plant were locked from the outside and the workers couldn't get out and died of smoke inhalation. Also, President Bush calls for a delay in loan guarantees to Israel.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Composer John Adams, poet Alice Goodman, choreographer Mark Morris, and stage director Peter Sellers were the creative team that gave us the opera Nixon in China in 1987. This year, they have a new opera based on the 1985 Palestinian hijacking of the cruise ship Achille Lauro. It's called The Death of Klinghoffer. It had its world premiere in Brussels in the spring, and its American premiere performances are at the Brooklyn Academy of Music this week. Critic Lloyd Schwartz was there Saturday night and has this review.
After Peter Sellers directed his powerful and controversial series of operas by Mozart and Handel, he announced that he didn't want to do any more traditional operas. He preferred to be involved with the creation of new ones. The first product of this effort was Nixon in China, which was avant-garde in its special slant on minimalist music, but which presented the story of the Nixon's visit to communist China in quite traditional ways. Sellers' next idea was to do an opera about the terrorists who shot an American tourist named Leon Klinghoffer and threw him overboard in his wheelchair. This time, Sellers and his teammates have taken a far less traditional approach. Klinghoffer is less like an opera than an oratorio. It has large choruses commenting on the action, a little like the chorales in the Bach Passions. The arias are mainly a series of reflective monologues by the captain of the Achille Lauro, the four Palestinian terrorists, Marilyn and Leon Klinghoffer, and other passengers and members of the crew. Some of the music is hauntingly beautiful, especially the opening chorus of Palestinian exiles, which builds from tender nostalgia to a violent outburst against the Israelis. But I think the lack of traditional interaction, along with the difficult abstractness of the words, are big problems, because a lot of the music, especially the music for solo voice, hasn't much distinct character. Here, the captain and his first officer and a Swiss grandmother each separately remember the moment of discovering the terrorists, and they all sound a little alike. The selections we're playing today, conducted superbly by Kent Nagano, were recorded at the world premiere in Brussels last spring. It's the same cast and conductor that's appearing at the Brooklyn Academy of Music. James Maddalena, who sang the original Nixon, makes the tormented captain a kind of modern Pontius Pilate. Janice Felty is the Swiss grandmother, and Thomas Hammonds is the officer. The New York Times attacked the death of Klinghoffer for being too sympathetic to the Palestinians and too satirical towards the Jews. The opera certainly touches some tender political areas. But I don't think the Times is right. In the best aria, sung magnificently by baritone Sanford Sylvan, Klinghoffer takes a heroic stand against one of the terrorists. It's Klinghoffer who's the real hero of this opera.
I've never been a violent man. Ask anyone. I'm a person who just as soon avoid trouble. But somebody's got to tell you the truth. I came here with my wife. We both have tried to live good lives. We give gladly, receive gratefully. Come and take pleasure in small things. Suffer and comfort each other.
The terrorists may not be entirely unsympathetic, but they are pretty ugly in their hatred. A terrorist named Rambo sings, "America is one big Jew." And they look foolish in their confusion and self-destructiveness. In one key moment, one of the terrorists, Mahmoud, sung by Eugene Perry, tells the captain about the death of his mother and the decapitation of his brother. It's so moving, the captain says, "I think if you could talk like this to your enemies, peace would come." But Mahmoud answers, "The day that I and my enemy sit peacefully, each putting his case and working towards peace, that day our hope dies, and I shall die too." These terrorists don't want peace. And at the end, Marilyn Klinghoffer won't give up her hatred either. This painful opera is not optimistic about peace. Peter Sellers has given Klinghoffer an inspired production. For all its complexity and ambition, though, I wish its music and words were as consistently inspired. By the way, the entire score will air on NPR stations across the country at various times during the next couple of months. Check with your local public broadcasting stations for the exact times.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. The death of Klinghoffer concludes its run at the Brooklyn Academy of Music tomorrow. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Roberta Shurrock and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross. ¶¶
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Dr. C. Everett Koop was the Reagan administration's Surgeon General. He says the administration wanted to use the position to promote their social agenda. He saw his job differently. Dr. Koop has written his memoirs, and on the next Fresh Air, he discusses his conflicts with the Reagan administration on abortion and AIDS. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.